Hello and welcome to another episode of The Secrets of Harry Potter. We'll be focusing on the music in the Harry Potter universe. The music that you hear in the films, we'll be discussing them, analyzing them, going in depth. My name is Lynn Francisco, and I am coming to you from North Carolina. And with me on this journey, we have in Louisiana, Denise Roper.
Hi.
And also joining me from Mexico, Ariadna Quijano.
Hello, everybody.
Hi. So why don't we go ahead and get started? As you all well know, in the 8 Harry Potter films, we had 4 different composers take care of the music for each of them. We had John Williams composing the music for the first 3 films. Patrick Doyle composed the music for film number 4. Nicholas Hooper for films 5 and 6. And Alexandre Desplat for the last 2 films. We are going to focus on the music of John Williams. So we'll be talking about the music that he composed for Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone or Philosopher's Stone, Chamber of Secrets, and Prisoner of Azkaban. So, Denise, what can you tell us about the music?
Well, John Williams is probably the greatest film composer of all time. I was going to give a little bit of background information about John Williams for our listeners who may not be familiar with his other works outside of Harry Potter, although I'm sure many of them are familiar, which with some of the film scores he's written, such as music from all 6 Star Wars films, Superman, Indiana Jones, E.T. the Extraterrestrial, Jurassic Park, Schindler's List. The list goes on and on. His career has spanned nearly 6 decades.
Wow.
Which astounds me that he's still working as a composer. He hasn't retired yet. He's won 5 Academy Awards, 4 Golden Globes, 7 British Academy Awards, and 21 Grammys, according to Wikipedia. They said that John Williams is the second most nominated person for the Oscars, right after Walt Disney, who, of course, is holding the record for most Oscar nominations. So, I think that's really amazing. Williams was also inducted into the Hollywood Bowl Hall of Fame in 2000 and a recipient of the Kennedy Center Honors in 2004. Before he became famous as a composer, he was well known as a jazz pianist. He studied at Juilliard and also at UCLA. He did serve in the U.S. Air Force and conducted and arranged music for the U.S. Air Force Band as, you know, part of his assignments. And just a bit of trivia from my life, his score for The Cowboys, a film starring John Wayne, it's not one of his best-known scores, but it's a really, really great one. He wrote an arrangement for concert band of the Cowboys, which was premiered by the U.S. Air Force Band, and I think it was led by Colonel Gabriel at the time. He was friends with my band director, Frank Wicks, at LSU, and before the music was actually published, the handwritten parts were loaned to the LSU band. And Mr. Wicks conducted us in the civilian premiere of The Cowboys, you know, arranged for a concert band when I was in college. So I thought that was really neat.
That is cool. Wow.
Nice.
I mean, it really underscores just how long, you know, John Williams has been going at it. And then, of course, you know, I'm of the age where I was just a kid when the Star Wars series came out in the late 1970s. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I mean, that music, it was just so iconic. And, I mean, you know, you recognize John Williams' style immediately, as evidenced by the Star Wars series. And then, of course, you hear a lot of his brilliance in his film compositions in the later films that he worked on.
Yeah, I think his first Oscar was his orchestrations for Fiddler on the Roof. He didn't compose the original music. He adapted the Broadway score for the movie and I think wrote some additional music for the film. That was his first win. His first Oscar for original film score, though, was for Jaws in 1975. And he won again for the first Star Wars film in 1977. And also for E.T. the Extraterrestrial. I'm trying to remember the date on that one.
Had to have at least been 84 or 85.
1982, I think.
Oh, really? That early?
Yep. Okay. I was 8 years old. Yeah, I remember
and of
that.
Of course, the score for Schindler's List, which featured the violinist Itzhak Perlman.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely beautiful. One of the most beautiful scores I've ever heard. So, I mean, you know, he's got these amazing credentials, and I couldn't even list all the films that he's written a score for. If you want to look it up on Wikipedia, it's a very, very long list.
It was wonderful, wonderful that they were able to contract him to write the film score for at least the first Harry Potter film. And, of course, it's wonderful that they kept him on for at least the first three.
Oh, yeah. I always wished he would return, and I was really disappointed when he didn't. But, oh, well.
Well, he's a tough act to follow.
Mm-hmm.
I think any composer that would follow him on a project is really courageous.
Oh, indeed.
I mean, imagine the weight of that. It's like, okay, the previous three films were scored by John Williams. Oh, my gosh. I mean, that would be enough to freak anybody out, I think.
Yeah.
No, I mean, wouldn't it? I mean, it's like, oh, my. It's incredible. I mean, you have this space to fill that is gigantic.
Big shoes to fill,
yeah,
indeed.
Kudos to them. Yeah, definitely.
Now that we've finished heaping lots and lots of praise on John Williams and his very prolific career, how about if we start talking about some of the influences that John Williams may have had during the course of his compositions?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, he's quite the accomplished jazz pianist. And it's surprising to some people because they know his music as being more of a classical or neo-romantic style of orchestral music. But you will see in certain film scores that he's written the influence of jazz, such as the Cantina Band sequence in the original Star Wars film, or, you know, the night bus music in Prisoner of Azkaban. But really, I think he's one of the few film composers I can name right offhand that can write in nearly any musical genre that you would want, whether it's classical, romantic, you know, very dissonant, atonal, modern style, you know, and even going back to the past with, you know, Renaissance or medieval type music, he can compose just about any kind of music you would want on in a film score. But I think he's best known for his neo-romanticism. You know, inspired by the music of the 1800s with a very large orchestra, you know, with full instrumentation and then some, very emotional in style. And when I think of John Williams being influenced by other composers, I'm sure you could list plenty, but Wagner, Richard Wagner, the German romantic opera composer, comes to mind.
Oh, indeed.
Because of Wagner's use of leitmotif.
Ah. And for those who may not be familiar with what leitmotif is, can you please explain what that is?
Yes. Wagner made the use of leitmotif famous. So when you study music history and you learn this term, you'll see a lot of references to Wagner's music dramas, which is what he called his opera. And in this type of German opera that Wagner invented, the music drama, the orchestral music tells the story just as well as, you know, the libretto, the lyrics that the singers are performing. So really, you could eliminate all the vocal stuff, you know, all the lyrics and everything, and still know what's going on in the story by listening to the orchestra, because every main character, places, objects, themes, relationships between characters, all these different elements of the story have a little musical theme associated with it. A leitmotif could be a short musical motive, a musical phrase, you know, a full-blown melody, a rather lengthy one, or it can be a very short segment, such as a single chord or chord progression. But it's always used in association with a character, place, an object, or an idea in the opera. So when it comes to film scoring, John Williams is known for this. His Star Wars film scores, especially the original trilogy, you know, episodes 4, 5, and 6, made very extensive use of the whole leitmotif technique with, you know, all the major characters having their own little theme, or sometimes, you know, certain, I don't know how to describe it, like the Rebel Alliance or the Empire, you know, the opposing forces in the war, they each have their own little theme associated with it. So, you know, I looked at the Harry Potter scores and tried to determine, does John Williams do this in the score for Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone? And I would say, yes, he does.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
All the time.
I mean, if you have a look especially at the most iconic music that is associated with the Harry Potter series, it would have to be Hedwig's theme. But despite the fact that it's titled Hedwig's theme, to be honest with you, I don't really associate that theme with the owl. I actually associate it with Harry himself.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Hedwig's theme is heard on screen, you know, associated with Harry, when Hedwig is not even present in the scene, and still being used after Hedwig's death in Deathly Hallows 1. So I think it serves as the overarching theme of the entire Harry Potter series, just like Luke Skywalker's theme in Star Wars is the overall theme for the whole Star Wars saga. And I think it also serves as a theme for Harry himself.
It's actually the only theme that we hear throughout the saga, right? Hedwig's theme. I mean, even when there's nothing else that reminds you of Philosopher's Stone or Chamber of Secrets or something, there's always something. You can hear Hedwig's theme here and there. Yeah. Maybe not as obviously, but you can, definitely.
I would say that it makes its appearances as variations on a theme of. Like maybe you might have a little bit of, you know, a minor key here and there, but it's still recognizable as a variation of the main Hedwig's theme. And, of course, the way that it presents itself, I think, will also determine pretty much what the mood is that of a particular scene with which it's associated.
I found a website called 8notes.com. It's where you can download free sheet music. And there's a brief little article on there about Hedwig's theme. Whoever wrote this little article states that Hedwig's theme from Harry Potter owes a lot to Celtic folk music and traditional songs like Greensleeves or Scarborough Fair.
In particular,
the rhythm found in the opening bar, and he gives a musical example. And, you know, he compares this dotted quarter note followed by an eighth note followed by a quarter note rhythm to those types of Celtic folk music, you know, that he mentioned. So if you want to look that up, that's at www.8notes.com, and you'd have to search for Hedwig's theme on there. And the person who wrote this little article also mentions the unusual instrumentation that John Williams uses in the first film, especially with this theme. And he uses a very rare instrument called the celeste, which sounds something like the glockenspiel, the orchestral bells, but it's not that type of instrument that you play with little mallets. It looks like a miniature piano, and it has a tinkling sound like a music box. This instrument can be heard in famous pieces of classical music, such as in the Nutcracker Suite by Tchaikovsky, on the Dances of Sugar Plum Fairy, and also Gustav Holst makes use of the celeste in The Planets, which has been stated to be one of John Williams's influences, especially for the Star Wars film music.
That's very interesting. Going back to the Celtic influences, I was, as you mentioned that, immediately what popped into my head were both the melodies for Scarborough Fair. Da-da-dee-da-dee-da-da-da-da. You know, that just, that kind of of melody that you're, or rhythm that you were talking about with the quarter eighths and all of that. And then also, mm-hmm. of course, Greensleeves. Da, dee, da, 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 dee. You also hear that as well. So I think that that is a very, very interesting comparison that whoever had written that article made, with at least that piece of Hedwig's theme and those other very well-known pieces of music.
Besides Hedwig's theme, we have a number of other important leitmotifs or character themes, whatever you'd like to call them, in all of the films that John Williams scored. In the first film on the CD, I think there's a track called Harry's Wondrous World.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we have a couple of themes in there that I don't know if John Williams ever gave them names, but I tried to give them a nickname myself based on how they function in the films. I'm calling this one the friendship theme. So mm-hmm. listen for that one in the first movie, and I think I remember hearing it in Chamber of Secrets too. Whenever
it's
Harry,
always Harry, Ron, and Hermione are together and something good happens when Hagrid returns from Azkaban, stuff like that. Yeah, it's there.
So I've nicknamed that one the friendship theme. I don't know if John Williams gave it a name or not. And then there's another one that in the first movie seems to be associated with Harry's loss of his parents. I'm thinking of the Mirror of Erised theme. Sounds familiar?
Indeed, yes.
Yes. And it goes hand in hand with the friendship theme.
It does. And I think both of those are linked in his little concert piece called Harry's Wondrous World. That's another thing to note about listening to a John Williams film score CD. You'll have orchestral music on the CD that you can't quite place with a scene in the film, because if John Williams writes a character theme that he really likes, he'll make a concert arrangement of it for orchestras to play, you know, on concerts. And it wasn't necessarily meant to match with any specific scene in the film. It's just he wrote a great theme song for a character, so he decided to, you know, make a piece for performance out of it. So I know on the Harry Potter CDs and on the Star Wars CDs, there's a few examples of that. And, of course, it makes great in-title music, too.
Yeah, very true.
Right. So he's a little obsessive about that.
Well, I think he knows his music is going to be performed outside of, you know, just playing it for the film soundtrack.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And, I mean, that's true. It's not just him conducting his own music in concert. There's orchestras and concert bands all over the world that play his music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very true. What other motifs do we hear throughout the first film?
Well, there's one he calls Nimbus 2000, and I know it's associated with Quidditch a lot, or just perhaps general Harry mischief making. So you can interpret that one as you will.
Yeah, and I did. Yeah, I think that particular theme or that particular piece is familiar, because isn't that another one that makes its appearances in the later films as well?
Yeah, John Williams does reuse a lot of the themes from the first film in the second film.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And besides that, I mean, one might think, well, Harry gets into a lot of mischief throughout the entire series, so that would be the perfect mischief theme, right?
this music is, like, all over the place. I mean,
another really good leitmotif to listen for in the first film is that there's a little musical motive associated with the Sorcerer's Stone or the Philosopher's Stone. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of creepy and scary. I think it's maybe associated with Voldemort, too. So listen for... as a motif, whenever someone mentions the Sorcerer's Stone, or, you know, there's a scene involving Voldemort wanting to steal it and so forth.
Yeah, and even in the second film, it's like the theme, you know, for the Chamber of Secrets. And I mean, whenever Voldemort is involved, you can hear that.
And then I think it's kind of neat that, like real schools in our world, Hogwarts has an alma mater, if you want to interpret it as such. John Williams in the first film gave us a little piece he calls Hogwarts Forever. So to me, this serves as a leitmotif for the school. And I'm referring to this one. And you hear that little melody played in different styles. I think on the sound CD, you have this very majestic presentation of it played by French horns that does sound stately, like an alma mater. And then there's some more quick-paced, fanfare-ish settings of played by trumpets during the Quidditch match, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah. I mean, like, when I was listening to the soundtrack from the first film last night, and I thought, wow, that sounds almost stately, almost fanfare-ish, you know, like, and then, of course, I'm a church organist, and so I don't know why it pops into my mind that, oh, yes, imagine if some bride were to ask for this particular type of fanfare to be her, or recessional music as she walks down the aisle after she gets married. I mean, it has that kind of fanfare-ish, almost bombastic kind of feel.
But that's a great thing about the leitmotifs. They can basically be the same tune, but he'll change the instrumentation, the volume, the tempo, articulations, alter the rhythms, and he can make a theme completely change character and mood, and even though it's the same basic tune. John Williams is really brilliant at that, and again, that's from Wagner in his operas. I think John Williams' best example of that is how he uses Luke Skywalker's theme in the Star Wars movies. Mm-hmm. You know, the way that is played in the films is based on what is Luke doing in this scene. If it's under his dialogue, it might be played softly on woodwinds. You know, if he's going into battle, it might be a loud fanfare of brass. And, you know, it's amazing how you can take the same melody and portray it different ways to create different moods and emotions.
Right, and if it's something really, really serious, he could even do a variation in a minor key?
Yeah. Some other bits of trivia about the first film. Unusual instrumentation. We mentioned the celeste on Hedwig's theme. Mm-hmm. We have a contrabassoon solo on Fluffy's harp. I guess representing, you know, the huge three-headed dog snoring. So he picked the lowest instrument in the woodwind family, the lowest pitched one that you really don't hear a lot. Some composers don't even write parts for the contrabassoon in the Banner Orchestra. It's kind of an unusual instrument. But it is the lowest voice in the woodwind family, so he makes use of that instrument. On Diagon Alley, to create the mood of, you know, this is a really ancient place hidden away inside London, he uses medieval and Renaissance-type instruments, such as recorders.
Yeah, and then, of course, the percussion that goes along with it. If you get a chance, listen to that, to the Diagon Alley theme on the soundtrack, and you'll definitely get a feel of that. The sound of the recorders just kind of giving a kind of a dance-like feel, and then, of course, you've got the percussion in the background. You'll almost feel like that you're in a Renaissance there.
Yeah,
as you listen to that.
That's a good description of it. And then, of course, the costumes for the first film. When Harry sees the adult wizards and witches for the first time, the costumes were very old-fashioned. And I noticed in the later films, they've made the costumes a little bit more modern-looking. But it definitely gives it that retro feel. You know, this is something from an ancient time in the past. Speaking of percussion, the chess game scene features a lot of percussion instruments, and it really reminded me of some of the battle music in Star Wars.
Basically, on the giant chess match, it really is. If you think about it, it really is a battle. So I think scoring the music in that way, it's quite apt.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So do we have anything else that we could discuss about the first film?
Well, it was nominated for an Oscar for Best Original Score, and it didn't win. Mm-hmm. But I'm glad it was at least nominated.
Yeah, at least then it got its recognition that way.
And I believe that film came out the same time as the first Lord of the Rings movie. And Howard Shore won, I believe, for the Fellowship of the Ring. So I was glad Howard Shore won for that. You know, it's hard for me to decide between the two who I like best.
But the music for the Lord of the Rings in general, it's beautiful music. It's so powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and so, again, a great example of the use of leitmotif.
With that, let's go ahead and take a break before we discuss the next film. So let's now move on to the second film, Chamber of Secrets. And what can we say about the music in that film?
Well, John Williams introduces some new leitmotifs to go with new characters that enter the story, such as Gilderoy Lockhart. And again, with the unusual instrumentation, that one features a harpsichord, which was a keyboard instrument that was popular before the piano was invented. Lockhart's theme, if you're having trouble recalling it, sorry, I don't have a harpsichord here. I have a flute with me, but... if you remember that one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then, actually, one of my favorite themes from the second film was the theme song he wrote for the Chamber of Secrets. It's very mysterious and bombastic when it's played loudly. I was playing my Chamber of Secrets CD in the car one day, and my brother was in the car with me. He has never watched a Harry Potter movie or read the books.
Oh, my.
But he's a big Star Wars. He's a big Star Wars fan like me. And he asked me, oh, is that a Star Wars soundtrack that I haven't heard before? And I started laughing. I'm like, no, that's the theme from Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets. He didn't believe me at first. Is the Chamber of Secrets main theme, or at least that's how it starts off. And I think the reason he thought it might have been some Star Wars music that he hadn't heard before, listen to this. That's just one little segment of the overall theme. I'm going to take one note out.
Mm-hmm.
And Star Wars fans might know what I'm getting at.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Darth Vader.
Indeed.
Of course, the Empire.
Uh-huh. And so it's
interesting, though, that the Vader theme in Star Wars is related to other themes associated with Anakin. I know this might be off topic. Some people don't want to hear about Star Wars. But again, listen to what I just pulled from Chamber of Secrets and transformed into the Imperial March. The love theme from Star Wars Episode 2 for Anakin and Padme starts off with...
Mm-hmm.
So there's definitely a thematic relationship there between the Imperial March and the love theme.
It's very interesting, though, that the theme for the Chamber of Secrets, which, of course, in the film and in the books represents this underground... I don't know if you could necessarily call it desolate place. Of course, it's where the monster, the basilisk, lives. You know, I guess as we had discussed in previous episodes of this podcast, that the snake would be associated with, you know, I guess the less than savory elements. So interesting that you've got the music for the chamber itself, and comparing that with, say, the music from the Imperial March, you know, or even the music with Darth Vader's theme, you know, just, it's very interesting that you could relate that, you know, similarly, you know, dark and dark characters. So it's, I just think it's a very interesting comparison.
Another new character that's introduced in the second film is Dobby the House Elf.
Dobby!
John Williams gave him his own little theme.
Oh, Dobby!
If if you remember that little theme from the Chamber of Secrets soundtrack. Fox also has his own theme song.
Oh, Fox is the theme in that movie. It's beautiful.
I agree. I think that's one of the prettiest themes from the second film that he introduces. Which is one of my favorites from that soundtrack.
Yeah, and then in my mind, that it also evokes images of soaring as well, which is very, very appropriate for the Phoenix.
Yeah. Especially, yeah. You know, in that scene where they get out of the Chamber of Secrets and Lockhart screams, "Girl, this is just like magic!" It's like, oh my God, so beautiful. Like, it's, as you said, I mean, it evokes soaring and flying and being free, I don't know, something like that. It's beautiful.
Agreed. John Williams has written so many flying themes. The flying theme from E.T. the Extraterrestrial is just amazing. I'm thinking of the scene where the bicycles fly.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just so triumphant, and the music just soars right there. It's just so uplifting. And, of course, the Superman theme. For the original Superman movie with Christopher Reeve back in 78.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, various themes from Star Wars. And in Harry Potter, we have more than one flying theme besides Fox. I know in the third film, we get music for Buckbeak's flight, which I also love.
Mm-hmm. So we just talked about the soaring. What about those with all the little creepy legs down on the ground?
Oh, the spider theme. It's based on running 16th notes. And it represents like the eight-legged movement of the spiders. And if you're arachnophobic, even the music is scary.
That's true.
You think it's the way spiders move. I think that's what creeps Ron out about spiders, is the way they move, right?
And that's probably what creeps a lot of people out about spiders, too.
Yeah, that music is creepy. Definitely. Especially if you take into account that the spiders want to eat them. That's like the creepiest part.
Now, just out of curiosity, this just kind of popped into my head. Did we have any music, or was any music composed that reflected the flying car, the Ford Anglia?
Yes. I don't have the sheet music for it, but I'm pretty sure there's very... another flying theme that we had mentioned, you know, in that same vein as Fox and Buckbeak and all that. The music rises and falls a lot, and you get the impression that this flying car is not too stable. And maybe that's foreshadowing it's going to crash later on. And there's also these repetitive fast passages, like ba-da-da-da-da-dum, ba-da-da-da-da-dum, kind of like it reminds me of, you know, the engine running and the same thing over and over, like a machine. And I think there's a moment in there where we hear the friendship theme from the first Harry Potter movie. I guess Harry and Ron are having a friendship moment here when Ron comes to the rescue.
Oh, true. Is there anything else that we could say about Chamber of Secrets? Because, I mean, I'm sure we probably also have some themes and the like that were recycled from the first film.
Oh, I think so. There's a scene in Diagon Alley when Harry and Hermione are reunited, and we hear the friendship theme there, I believe. I don't know. I need to watch the movie again. The listeners, after hearing this show, may go back and want to watch the first three films and notice some of these musical cues. Most have all the dialogue memorized.
I think that would be a very, very good idea. Let's go ahead and take another break. And when we come back, we will discuss the music from the third film that Williams scored, Prisoner of Azkaban. And we're back. What new elements were introduced into this third film?
Bugbeak.
Double Trouble. And A Window to the Past. I think those are our major ones.
Well, Double Trouble, that's the choir, right? I think a choir was brought in to sing that one.
Yes, the Hogwarts School Choir mm-hmm. sings that, and the lyrics are from Shakespeare's Macbeth. So I'm looking through my sheet music book trying to find that.
Toil and trouble, right?
I'm not going to sing for
it. Well, actually, I probably could, but...
Double, double, toil and trouble, fire burn and cauldron bubble. Double, double, toil and trouble, something wicked this way comes. And when you hear the chords on something wicked this way comes, that's a leitmotif that's used throughout the Prisoner of Azkaban score. It's a little warning of danger, you know, something important is about to happen, maybe involving Sirius or Harry being in some type of danger. So I think it was really great that we even have lyrics to go with the leitmotif, something wicked this way comes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's used as a little musical signal throughout the score. When you watch the film, notice that.
We notice, too, that the tone of this film starts turning a little bit darker. And so, of course, the music is also reflecting that as well. Speaking of which, so if we go then to discussing The Window to the Past, so what can be said about that particular?
Oh, it's so melancholy. It's my favorite theme from the first three films, actually. I like the sadness of it. We always hear it like in scenes that Lupin is in or scenes at the end with Sirius. Anytime they're discussing James and Lily and you have all these, you know, sad moments with Harry and one of the Marauders talking about how much they miss, you know, Harry's mom and dad.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just beautiful. And I love the way he introduces it with a recorder.
Oh.
I don't have a recorder here, but I can play it on my flute.
Okay.
Yeah, A Window to the Past is this thing.
Beautiful.
Yeah, and then you could really hear how that would evoke emotion, I mean, especially with in connection to those particular characters.
And I just happen to like Sincerio, so any scene that Gary Oldman or David Thewlis is a good scene.
Indeed.
Yeah, they are great. They are. I loved David Thewlis as Lupin. I think I always thought he was perfect. Like, perfect, perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any other themes or leitmotifs that we could discuss from this particular film?
Flying music, box, and the flying car. And in this film, we get Buckbeak's flight.
Wow, that was quite majestic, wasn't it? And the way that it starts out, with the percussion, and then transitioning into these nice soaring melodies. So, what do you think that symbolizes?
Well, I think he starts out with the really bellicose sounding percussion at the beginning, to show that Harry might be in danger. You know, Buckbeak is...
Or that he's scared.
Yeah, this right? ferocious creature, and it makes the audience wonder for a moment, is Harry going to be hurt? And then the music takes off, and Harry goes on, you know, the flight of a lifetime. It becomes majestic and soaring, and really one of the most beautiful musical moments in the film.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed.
Yes.
I mean, also quite memorable as well, because, I mean, all of a sudden I'm having images in my mind of Harry just soaring over the Black Lake, I think that's what it's called, riding Buckbeak, and just, you know, and mm-hmm. just enjoying himself. His arms are spread wide, and he's giving whoops of joy. It's really pretty joyous, I think.
I'm the king of the world?
Indeed, that too.
Oh, no, please don't. No, I don't like that.
Well, you know, there are also other bits and pieces as well. I mean, Hagrid, the professor, remember that he becomes the Care of Magical Creatures professor in this particular film. And mm-hmm. he has even a specific style of music that's assigned to him. So let's just listen to a small snippet of that. So, what do you think? A throwback?
I think he uses some medieval instruments here, such as the shawm, which is a type of medieval oboe, and to evoke a mood. You know, just like with Diagon Alley and the recorders, we have some musical instruments that are not very common in the modern era. You only hear them in early music recitals where, you know, people reenact how music sounded in the medieval period or the Renaissance or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was very effective, the way he used those ancient instruments mm-hmm. for Hagrid the Professor.
Indeed. Now, here's another interesting one. Remember that the Time Turner actually makes its appearance in this particular episode, with Hermione using it just to be able to keep up with her studies. But then the Time Turner also takes on a pretty important role towards the end of the film. Let's listen. So, yeah, what do you think of that one?
I like the way he used the ticking of the clock
uh-huh.
during the Time Turner sequence.
Mm-hmm.
It just kind of creates,
a mood.
Of tension, this yeah. relentless passage of time that can't be stopped. You hear the constant ticking.
Yes. I think it's of course, also thanks to this musical introduction, this is maybe the best scene of the movie.
And visually, we have the image of the camera moving through the gears of the huge clock.
Oh, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
And we know at this moment, you know, Harry and Hermione have gone through time. So literally, the audience has passed through time symbolically by, you know, going with the camera through the inside mm-hmm. of the clock.
And then, finally, we have another theme that was prevalent through this film as well. At least, you know, in the books they were. And that's the Dementors, those scary creatures. And Williams also wrote a theme to go along with them. Let's listen. Your thoughts?
Creepy.
Definitely.
It is.
The music for
it is like a horror movie style.
That's exactly what I was thinking. And it shows the influence of music of the modern era, as far as, you know, 20th century music, where composers were experimenting with extreme dissonance and music that's very mm-hmm. unpleasant to listen to, you know, the high screechy strings and, you know, unpleasant harmonies that, you know, are difficult to listen to.
Yeah, I think yeah. The effect really is that it's, I think he's meaning to evoke fear with all of that.
And also fear and the feeling of something nasty, displeasing. You know, it's like when you hear nails against a chalkboard. You're like,
yeah.
And you go like, oh, yeah, like that.
Yeah.
Like, it's unpleasant. It's not only not harmonious, but it's unpleasant to hear. It's like you just want it to stop. Like, you want these dementors to just go because they are so annoying.
True. I mean, they basically suck the life out of you. And so I think that theme music definitely evokes that feeling as well. Is there any other thoughts that we have on this film, The Prisoner of Azkaban, or even of John Williams's music in general, as far as the Harry Potter series is concerned?
I think the score to Prisoner of Azkaban really shows how dark the films have gotten compared to the first two, with, you know, so much dissonant music, like for the Dementors, or the Night Bus music, which is some very, I guess, atonal sounding jazz. It's not easy on the ears either. And film score critics actually really liked this album. I know it was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Achievement in Music Written for a Motion Picture, Original Score, Grammy for Best Score Soundtrack Album for a Motion Picture, and the World Soundtrack Award for Best Original Soundtrack. So I think, you know, since it was John Williams' last contribution to the Harry Potter series, it definitely was recognized, you know, for being quality work. Even though it didn't win the Oscar, at least it had a nomination for it.
And so with that, I think it's time to call it an episode. So, Denise, Ari, it was a pleasure. Thank you very much. Goodbye, everybody.